Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Qatar's top diplomat, Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, has given Kuwait his government's response to a list of demands by four countries that cut ties with Doha last month over its alleged support of terrorism, a charge it denies. Kuwait is acting as a mediator. Details have not been made public. Qatar has denied the charges and appeared ready to reject the demands by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. This month's UN Security Council President, Chinese Ambassador Liu Jieyi, said he hopes for a diplomatic solution.
The best way would be the countries concerned work out a solution through dialogue and through consultations among themselves, because we don't see any other alternative.
The demands include the withdrawal of Turkish troops from Qatar and closure of the Qatari state-owned Al Jazeera network. Kuwait University political science professor Shafiq Gabra said support for Qatar's emir remains strong.
I was in Doha before the boycott and the blockade, and I am in Doha after the blockade, and I do see that difference. The popularity of the emir and the popularity of the system and its policy at large has gained quite a momentum.
President Donald Trump has appealed for regional unity to fight terrorist financing. A two-day African Union summit is open in Ethiopia, with AU chief Musa Faki Mohamed expressing frustration over the inability to address famine. Some 20 million people face malnutrition and famine in Yemen, Somalia, South Sudan, and Nigeria. This is VOA News. Syria Monday proclaimed a unilateral ceasefire in the south until Thursday, ahead of the latest round of Russia-sponsored talks in the Kazakh capital Astana. It said the truce is aimed at promoting reconciliation. Rebel factions will not attend the talks. Meanwhile, Syria's Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal Mekdad has questioned the credibility of the organization for the prohibition of chemical weapons, saying inspectors have so far failed to visit key sites linked to an April chemical weapons attack that killed nearly 90 people.
Why the Syrian government, at a time when its forces are advancing everywhere, when national reconciliation is achieved in many parts of Syria, is reverting to the use of chemical weapons, which make the international public opinion feel unhappy and dissatisfied about what the Syrian government is doing?
Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has appointed French legal expert and former judge Catherine Marchi-Uel to head an investigation into possible war crimes in Syria. South Korea Tuesday said the North launched another ballistic missile with a flight duration of some 40 minutes before crashing into the Sea of Japan. The launch occurred just days before a G20 summit in Germany. China's UN ambassador Liu Shiji Monday warned further escalation of Korean tensions could get out of control with disastrous consequences.
Three things are essential: denuclearization, peace and security, peace and stability, and also negotiations and dialogue to seek solutions.
He pressed for adoption of China's suspension for suspension plan, whereby the North suspends its nuclear missile programs. The U.S. and South Korea suspend their joint military exercises. President Trump plans to meet G20 host German Chancellor Angela Merkel Thursday on the eve of the summit in Hamburg. The White House said Mr. Trump and the German leader spoke by phone Monday. He also conversed with Italian Prime Minister Paolo Gentiloni. In Niger, suspected Boko Haram insurgents killed at least 9 people and abducted at least 30 more from the border town of Ingouela late Sunday. Last week, 2 suicide bombers blew themselves up and killed 2 others at a nearby refugee camp. Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos has returned to Spain a month after receiving medical treatment. The government has declined to comment on the 74-year-old leader's condition. Amid reports he has suffered a stroke, Mr. dos Santos, who's been in power for nearly 40 years, announced he will not contest next month's election. Brazilian police have arrested a former cabinet minister in the government of President Michel Temer. He's been charged with obstruction of justice. Mr. Temer himself at risk of being suspended over corruption allegations. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 4th, and it's Independence Day here in the United States. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Amnesty International accuses both South Sudan military and rebels of committing atrocities.
Civilians are really bearing the brunt of these violence. They have been killed in the most brutal way, shot, hacked to death, burned alive. Women and girls have been gang raped in their homes.
Donatella Rovera is Amnesty International's senior crisis response advisor and author of a new report. South Sudan's government says its army is there to protect and not to kill innocent civilians. And Kenya says its security forces are ready for any violence during the country's August 8th election.
We've mapped out the country. We know we have about like 22 areas that we identify as potential hotspots. We've done additional deployment of security officers in case there is need for military intervention.
Mwenda Njoka is spokesperson for Kenya's Interior Ministry. Zambia's main opposition party condemns plans by the government to build a new $20 million state house. And the president of France pledges support for the fight against terrorism in Africa's Sahel region. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International has accused both the South Sudan military and their allied militias, as well as rebels, of committing atrocities in violation of international law. In a new report released Monday night, Amnesty says civilians, mostly in the country's Equatorial region, were shot, hacked to death with machetes and burned in their homes, and women and girls were abducted and gang-raped. The report said the atrocities have resulted in the mass displacement of close to a million people fleeing to neighboring Uganda as refugees. Donatella Rovera is Amnesty International's senior crisis response advisor and author of the report. She says the report is based on interviews conducted by Amnesty researchers during a visit to Equatoria last month.
I have just come back from South Sudan, and one of the regions I visited is the Equatorial region, a region that until very recently had been spared the violence that has been ravaging the country since 2013, but which over the past year has been experiencing tremendous levels of violence against civilians, mostly by government forces and militias that are aligned to government forces, but also to a lesser extent by armed opposition groups. And civilians are really bearing the brunt of these violence. They have been killed in the most brutal way, shot, hacked to death, burned alive. Women and girls have been gang raped in their homes or when they go to the rural areas trying to find some food for the basic survival for themselves and their children. And also because both government forces and rebel groups use food as a weapon of war, essentially, preventing civilians from even transporting whatever little food there is.
And your report is based on what? You said interviews with people who have fled the area?
I was both in South Sudan, and I interviewed people in South Sudan, both in government-controlled areas, cities like Yei, as well as in rebel-held areas near the border with Uganda, but inside South Sudan, where a lot of people who have escaped are sheltering there. And also in neighboring Uganda, I was in northern Uganda where people were crossing the border from South Sudan into northern Uganda at a rate of over 2,000 per day. So I spoke to people there as well.
Your report says that also the armed opposition fighters, that they have also committed these atrocities, but basically based on someone's ethnicity?
Yes, belonging to one ethnic group or another has taken a greater dimension in the conflict in South Sudan. And this is true also of the Equatorial region, where this wasn't the case. Armed rebels have been targeting people just because they are Dinka from the main tribe, which is the tribe to which the president belongs. Because just belonging to that tribe makes them seen as being supporters of the government. or they have targeted people from the Nuba region of Sudan who are sheltering in South Sudan, again, because they are perceived as being government supporters. And government forces, on the other hand, they have brought into the area a militia called the Matianga Nyor. They are notoriously undisciplined, brutal, and they know that they can behave that way because they enjoy impunity.
Let me say, I had a chance to talk with the spokesman for President Salva Kiir, and he said that there's no way that South Sudan government forces can do what Amnesty is claiming. Besides, he says that Amnesty is not giving the government credit for what it does. For example, he cited the government being engaged, involved with a national dialogue.
Well, obviously, any initiative with work towards ending the conflict would be welcome. The problem is that at the moment, what is needed is for the government and for the top brass in the armed forces to rein in their fighters, because the reason why 2,000 people or more are fleeing the Equatorial region alone every day to go and seek refuge in the neighboring country in northern Uganda is because they are not safe, because they're being attacked. So if that many people, close to 1 million people, have fled the Equatorial region into northern Uganda, if that many people are in that terrible situation, it is time for the spokesperson of the president of South Sudan to stop being in denial and to actually look at what the government can and must do to bring these atrocities to an end.
Donatella Rovera is Amnesty International Senior Crisis Response Advisor and author of a new report on South Sudan. She was speaking with me from London, United Kingdom. A spokesman for South Sudan, President Salva Kiir, has denied that South Sudan's security forces killed civilians in violation of international law. Atain Wekatain says while it is true that from time to time a single soldier may go against the law and harm civilians, overall, he says, the South Sudan Army is a revolutionary army that is there to protect people. This comes after Amnesty International, in a new report released on Monday night, accused both the South Sudan military and rebels of committing atrocities, mostly in the country's Equatorial region. Wekatain says South Sudan is in a better shape today than ever because of the national dialogue, which he said many South Sudanese are responding to positively, and that Amnesty International should have credited the government for these developments.
First of all, I would like to categorically disagree with the writers of this report on the fact that the government does not have to and has no reason why it has to kill civilians in order to fight with the insurgents. There is a challenge that the country is undergoing, a very difficult situation, considering that pockets of rebellions are actually operating and they are determined to target civilians. As you have seen, the members of the SPLM-IO, that is the, you know, they claim to be part of Machar, they claim the killing of the civilian on Juba Nimuli Road last month. They claim it that they have actually attacked the civilian simply because the civilian were escorted by the army. And that is categorical clear that, yes, the rebels are actually targeting civilians. But why would the government attack the civilian when in actual fact it is because of the civilian that the government is there to stay?
The report says that numerous eyewitnesses in the villages around Ye told Amnesty International how government forces and the allied militia deliberately killed civilians with reckless abandonment. So you are saying your government forces did not do that?
Our army is a revolutionary-driven army, and their main work is to ensure the same people in which they came from are actually protected. Yes, in some cases, you may find a situation whereby one single soldier from SPLA may go astray or may go against the law and do something against, you know, the civilian in one particular moment. But it's not the government policy to make the army target civilians. The army is there simply because the civilians are there. In some cases, you will find witnesses giving an account that because of how South Sudan and how the country is so polarized, some civilian would want just to accuse the SPLA for killing civilians. If the SPLA is to go out now and kill civilians and take it from me, there would be no single person to remain in South Sudan. It is because the SPLA is protecting the civilian. That is why there are civilians in many places, even in the equatorial region. I disagree on the fact that, you know, those who want to say the SPLA is killing civilians is not true. Because if the SPLA is killing civilians, then why would anybody remain so that he can be a witness?
The report is also saying that Amnesty International documented what they call gender-based violence. Abduction of women and rape of women and girls has skyrocketed. Have you received any report that this is going on?
The Amnesty International job in most cases is to ensure that, you know, when there is a fighting in the country, you know, the writers would just, you know, write any report simply because they have to do something in a country that has war in. They don't talk about countries that has no war. But to be honest, South Sudan is in better shape, you know, than any other time, simply because the national dialogue has been responded by all people. And the SPLA has less attack to encounter from the rebels, as the SPLA is observing a ceasefire. So they should be giving credit to the government of South Sudan for having declared ceasefire from one side, and they have continued to uphold the ceasefire. South Sudan is improving, and Amnesty International should say this.
You mentioned the national dialogue. There are some people who are saying that this is a facade by your government to pretend that something is going on, that this national dialogue is not really going to take place. Bring us up to date, because a delegation from the dialogue committee went to South Africa to meet with rebel leader Riek Machar. We are told that Dr. Machar refused to meet with the delegation.
I'm not yet sure, or I have not yet been informed as to whether they have met Dr. Riek Machar, the delegation from the Steering Committee of National Dialogue, or not. But should that information come to me, I will be able to share it with you. However, those who say National Dialogue is just a ploy for the government to see something that, you know, just to shoot people as if something is happening.
Atain Wek Atain, the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir, he was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 4th, and it's Independence Day here in the United States. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 18 minutes past the hour. Human Rights Watch says as the election nears in Kenya, some communities living in the Rift Valley region live in fear of attacks, and some people have started leaving after young men warned them to stay away from polling centers. The rights organization is calling on authorities to investigate and prosecute those behind the threats and intimidation. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
With just 5 weeks to the general election, some people are thinking whether to vote or head to their original homes after getting threats against those who may vote against the ruling Jubilee Party. Human Rights Watch researcher Otisiano Namwaya says the threats have some families are planning to abandon their homes.
We also had some direct threats of people telling their colleagues that let's wait for August 8th and we shall see where you'll go. We shall be coming for you, those kind of utterances. So people are afraid and people are leaving, and we think, or some of the families told us that they're waiting for schools to close and they will leave the area.
The Rights Agency two-week investigation focuses on Naivasha in Nakuru County, 90 kilometers from the capital, Nairobi. It was one of the worst hit areas by violence after the 2007 election that was driven in part by ethnic divisions. Kenya's electoral risk mapping shows 17 counties out of 47 have been identified as conflict-prone areas. Nakuru County is expected to experience election-related violence. In June, the Interior Ministry opened a command center to respond to terrorism and election violence. Hundreds of officers from security agencies are training around the country to prevent violence tied to the election, with the goal of having credible, peaceful election and stability in the weeks surrounding Election Day. But Namwaya says police officers lack the ability to respond if violence erupts in August.
We did get the impression that police have done much. There were incidents where people are claiming that they have made reports to police and there was no response. But we also found that the relationship between the police and the community is not so good.
Interior spokesperson Mwenda Njoka says security agencies are ready to stop electoral-related violence.
We've mapped out the country. We know we have about like 22 areas that we identify as potential hotspots, where we've done additional deployment of security officers from various formations, from various groups, both the civil and also military, in case there is need for military intervention in some areas.
The head of the European Union Observer Mission, Maritia Shaka, told reporters that election violence is very possible.
It is no secret that there are concerns about the possible outbreak of violence. This is not inevitable, and it is clear that it would create a situation where everybody loses. There is a responsibility for each and everybody to grant each other the right and safety to vote.
Kenya's election is August. President Uhuru Kenyatta hopes to win a second term against several challengers, including former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, has condemned plans by the government to construct a new $20 million state house. Works and Supply Minister Matthew Nkungwa says it is necessary to build a new state house because the current one has developed cracks which make it unsafe for President Edgar Lungu. But the opposition and civil society groups say it is a waste of taxpayers' money at a time when the economy is struggling. Charles Kakoma, spokesman for the main opposition UPND, tells viewers Peter Clotty that it is unfortunate that the government would pump $20 million into a project which, he says, is not a priority for the country.
That is a shocking, it is strange, it is a waste of resources. It is coming at a time when the Zambian government has gone on its knees begging to the International Monetary Fund for a bailout because the country is broke. Now, to imagine that you can spend $20 million on a project that is not a priority is shocking. Previous presidents have stayed in that state house. There was no problem. They enjoyed it. It has been renovated several times. And the previous president, Michael Sata, who died, canceled that contract to build a new state house because he thought that it was not necessary.
This state house was built in the 1930s by the British colonial rulers. At a time, the government argues that it is old, lot of money has been spent in refurbishing it instead of being used for other priority areas to improve the living conditions of Zambians. Your reaction to that?
Well, there are so many old buildings that we are using, including the cabinet office and so on in Zambia. That does not make it that when a building is old, then it must be discarded. There are so many other old buildings, including the White House in America and Downing Street in Britain. They are all old buildings, but they are functional. So there is no problem with having a president living in an old building. For as long as it is habitable, he can live there. There is no need to construct a new building. So we do not agree that because the building is old, then it must be discarded.
Well, the Works and Supply Minister, Matthew Nkungwa, has said that the current state house has cracks and can collapse anytime if there's an earthquake or a tremor. That could potentially put the president's life in danger.
No, in any case, the way the state house is built is that where the president sleeps is not even the main building of the state house. It's another house where he sleeps, not the office itself, which has cracks. And our suspicion is that that project is just being brought to siphon money from the country because it's going to be given to a Chinese company, which has already been involved in a lot of corruption scandals. So we do not even trust that Chinese company to build that state house.
Are you therefore saying that the government is violating the tender process and that there was no tender as demanded by law in Zambia?
There was no tender floated. It is being sourced directly to a Chinese company. That is what is growing this suspicion. Why is he sourced it directly to a Chinese company? There was no tender. And there will be no public evaluation of state house to verify the claims that they are saying that the state house is cracking and is not safe for the president and so on. No one had done any evaluation, including government evaluation department. They haven't done that. It has not been brought to the attention of the Zambians that there is this report. State house is very good. It's one of the best places that the Zambians look forward to going to because it has all the luxuries in the world that you can think of. The building is okay.
So if the building is okay, as you said, and something were to happen to the president, who takes the blame for it?
I can tell you nothing will happen to the president. The building is one of the strongest that we have in Zambia. The claim that it is about to collapse is fake. Like the American president says, it's fake news. There's no way that building can collapse. If it collapses, all the other buildings in Zambia will collapse.
The government has insisted, as I was telling you, previous amount of money constantly being used to renovate the building is not cost effective and draining the public purse, and that voting $20 million that will be budgeted for is a best use of Zambia's scant resources at the moment. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, you see, that is a lot of money for this country. And the State House is not just one building. You need to build almost a new compound, even for security people and so on and so forth, new offices and so on. That is totally unnecessary. In any case, in the Zambian situation, there is not just a State House, but there are also other buildings that the president can stay in. There is a State Lodge, and in every region, there are all these State Lodges. The president can always stay there. Why insist on demolishing one building to build a new one?
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. French President Emmanuel Macron has announced military and financial support to a group of countries fighting terrorism in Africa's Sahel region. Macron was in Mali on Sunday to consolidate Western backing for a five-nation regional force against the militants. During his visit, an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group based in Mali released a video of six foreign hostages it is holding for ransom. VOA's Lateef Kahoke reports.
Macron called for a united effort to eradicate terrorism, warning against calling it a war.
And I would not talk of a war as such, because that is what they want. And for that, you would require an enemy worthy of the name. But every day, we face terrorists, thugs, murderers, whose names and faces we must forget, but whom we must steadfastly and with determination eradicate altogether.
Macron said his country will provide operational and combat support for the anti-insurgent forces in the region, including 70 tactical military vehicles, communication kits, and protection equipment for the soldiers.
From now on, the Sahel represents 50% of our security and defense cooperation budget in the world, because here is where the security of the continent of Africa is being contested. And more generally, the security of a good part of our planet, Europe included.
Mali is hosting a summit with Niger, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania, known as the G5 Sahel. The heads of state of those five countries launched a regional force Sunday that will deploy thousands of troops into the vast arid areas of the Sahel that serve as a breeding ground for insurgent groups considered to be a threat to Europe.
Our countries are now theaters in which to hide weapons of all kinds, a haven for foreign fighters, terrorists running away from the international operations in Syria, as well as binationals transiting through our region trying to get to Europe.
Terrorist groups in the region resort to trafficking and kidnapping for ransom to support themselves. On Sunday, a terrorist group in Mali released a video of six hostages it has been holding for ransom. Three of them are women. Last week, Sweden announced the release of Johan Gustafsson, who was held by Islamic extremists in Mali for 6 years. But many governments refused to pay ransom to discourage more kidnapping in the future. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Amnesty International has accused both the South Sudan military and their allied militias, as well as rebels, of committing atrocities in violation of international law. In a new report released Monday night, Amnesty says civilians, mostly in the country's equatorial region, were harmed. That's it for this Tuesday, July 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns. I'm James Butte, wishing you a very nice day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.